One day I was working here and it came to me, the deprived and the dislocated. And then the word came to me, ruthless, the walking wounded. There was another phrase that was in my mind, the last ditch, the last ditch.
She could have just taken the pictures and shut up. She could have just focused on the craft, on the picture's composition, on the framing and processing, and collected her checks. But taking photographs showed her things she couldn't unsee. And she wanted to ensure that everyone saw them in all their dirty, unjust glory. How did one woman take pictures so powerful that they were both celebrated and banned? How did a worker with unprecedented access create a living visual library that showed our country's desperate injustice? And what can we learn from Dorothea Lange and her photos of migrants in the 1930s and incarcerated Japanese Americans in the 1940s? About making art as resistance. From Rebel Yell Creative, this is The Art of Resistance, a podcast about using writing, music, and all kinds of art to resist the status quo. I'm your host and producer, Amy Lee Lillard. And I'm an author, a podcaster, and middle-aged queer autistic weirdo who's been obsessing over artists who resisted since I was a kid. And today, I'm looking to make all the dangerous art and help others do the same. Dorothea Lange was born in New Jersey in 1895. She had polio at a young age, which left her with a lifelong limp. At age 10, her father walked out, and the family had to move in with their immigrant grandmother in the crowded, poor, and rowdy community of Lower East Side Manhattan. Dorothea knew early on that she liked photography. Why this particular art form? This is her in an archival interview.
The human face is the universal language. The same expressions are readable, understandable all over the world. Its explosions of emotion and passion all concentrate on just this part of the human anatomy.
In New York, as a young person, Dorothea convinced local photographers to let her help and learn. And when she moved to San Francisco in 1918, she quickly found work at a photography studio. Very soon after that, she found a backer to help her open her own studio. And she made a good living taking pictures of the wealthy. She was thriving. But then she fell in love and got married to another artist, a painter. And not so different from today. Getting married meant she had to prioritize her family. She had to prioritize her husband and his artistic work and put her own work and passions aside. She chafed at the restrictions, the expectations, but she did it because that's what you did. And that's what you do today as a woman. In the 1920s in America, the fabulously wealthy got more rich, along with regular folks trying to get their own on the exploding stock market. This is why we associate the decade with opulence and parties and bootleg booze. Then in 1929, it all came crashing down. The stock market collapsed, and wealth disappeared. For those who had had money before, they would typically rally and continue on. But for most who had either lost money in the stock market or worked for those who did, they lost everything. Factories around the country closed, banks everywhere stopped making loans, and eventually 1 in 4 people would lose their job. Dorothea and her family also struggled. No one was taking portraits anymore. And that struggle revealed all the tensions in the marriage. Eventually, they separated, and Dorothea decided to leave her children most of the time with her husband so she could work. She scrounged up some clients who still had the money to take portraits. But in between these sessions, she would look out through her studio windows and see destitute, desperate men milling around on the street. She saw misery and fear, and she got her camera. Dorothea took pictures of men lined up for a nearby soup kitchen. Then she moved to makeshift camps for the homeless. She took pictures of brewing battles between the poor and the police. And then she saw how it was all spreading. By the early 1930s, the Great Depression had decimated the workforce. But then, changing climate came for even more. This is Mary Patterson from the Bill of Rights Institute describing what came to be known as the Dust Bowl in a 2023 presentation.
Typically, the 1920s are referred to as the Roaring Twenties when we talk about U.S. history, but for many small farmers, this wasn't the case. The 1920s was actually a time of struggle, and when the Great Depression hits, it only exacerbates a difficult situation. In the Great Plains, decades of intensive farming, a long drought, and record high temperatures set off another disaster known as the Dust Bowl. So just by way of background, the Great Plains is this area west of the Mississippi River and east of the Rocky Mountains, and it's a prairie, so it has native prairie grass that hold the soil down. So these decades of intense farming pulled up the grass so the soil was loose. So the winds that naturally occur on the prairie, coupled with the high temperatures, coupled with the drought, meant that these storms of dust were really becoming more frequent and increasingly deadly. So a lot of these small farmers living in the Great Plains have no choice but to pack up and head west. They have to leave their land and hope for something better. So once these families, you know, reach their destination, which for some was California, but it could also be other places where they could look for work on farms, they didn't really find the promised land that they were looking for. So most of the farms in California especially are owned by corporations or large landowners. So there's no land to be had. They're only looking for work if you can find it, and it's pretty difficult. So there's not much work, there's not much money, there's really nowhere for a lot of these places to go, and they end up settling in what are called ditchback camps. And they're called that because they're settling along these irrigation ditches, their water source.
So more than 1 million people left their farms and headed to California looking for work. After all of her photographic work, Dorothea was eventually employed by a federal agency looking to better understand the impact of these two forces, the Depression and the Dust Bowl. So she hit the road. She watched these families coming in from the east. She took pictures of lines of cars loaded up with everything the families owned, heading to the west. She took pictures of what happened when they got there, the shanty towns, the migrant camps.
No one was ever given exact direction. You were turned loose in a region. And the assignment was, see what is really there. What does it look like? What does it feel like? What actually is the human condition?
In 1936, Dorothea visited a pea picker's camp, and she found one mother surrounded by children. They all looked so desperate and so hungry. she took a picture. And that picture, Migrant Mother, went on to be one of the best-known photos around the world.
I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I got them Dust Bowl blues. I just blowed in and I'll blow back out again. I've seen the dust so black that I couldn't see a thing. I've seen the dust so black that I couldn't see a thing.
How do you tell others about what you think is worth telling?
In 1941, the Nazis were invading and occupying the rest of Europe. Then the German allies of Japan attacked the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. The U.S. had tried to stay out of the growing war in Europe, but they immediately declared war on Japan. Then Germany. Now, for those of us who remember September 11th, we can remember the shock, the fear of being attacked. And we can remember the resulting hysteria that spread across the country. As the government immediately attacked and declared war against the countries that supposedly housed Al-Qaeda, people all over the U.S. took that as permission to attack Muslim citizens and immigrants. There were growing calls for incarceration, for deportation, for bans. And that hysteria still lingers, it still echoes today. That phenomenon, that hysteria, that happened in 1941, too. But the government actually went through with it. They decreed that all Japanese Americans in California and surrounding states be rounded up and incarcerated for the duration of the war. At the time, in California especially, Japanese Americans were thriving. They owned businesses and farms. They had nice houses and communities. And they lost it all with Executive Order 9066 from President Roosevelt. All people of Japanese ancestry, even those who were citizens who were born in the U.S., were given 7 days to pack up a suitcase and get on a bus. 116,000 Americans were moved from their homes, first to assembly centers. These were hastily prepared warehouses and other facilities, like a Bay Area racetrack, where families were kept in horse stalls. After some months there, everyone was moved to prison camps, like Manzanar, in the middle of a bleak desert with mud, sand, and dust storms. Meanwhile, as the U.S. had locked every Japanese American up, they still recruited Japanese American boys from the camps to fight and die in the war for the U.S. Right when the executive order was made, the U.S. government called on Dorothea. They wanted her to take pictures of the entire process, of the Japanese Americans getting on the buses, moving to assembly centers, and then life in the camps. The idea was to show that this whole thing wasn't that bad. The government wasn't hurting anyone, they were just being cautious. Bringing Dorothea on, it backfired on the government. This is Linda Gordon, professor of history at NYU and author of the book A Life Beyond Limits, speaking in 2009.
She was living in California, and she was already a government photographer. That made her the logical person to do it. But after she did this job, which she did in 1942, when the major, the U.S. Army major in charge of this whole operation, saw the photographs, they were so unmistakably critical that he impounded them for the duration of the war and put them in some private place. Then after the war, they were released. They were quietly placed in the National Archives. They've been in the National Archives ever since. Anyone could call up those pictures and look at them. And in fact, they're now available, many of them on the web. But people just didn't know that.
Dorothea was deeply against this entire thing, and she saw the blatant hypocrisy. The U.S. was now at war with Japan, Germany, and Italy, but they were only bringing together Japanese-American citizens for these camps. But Dorothea took the job, her thought being at least she could document what was really going on. And just as she had done with the migrant workers in other communities, she set out to capture reality. And the reality was of normal people being torn from their homes and incarcerated for no other reason than their genealogy and how they looked. Now, it wasn't known at the time, but the Germans were doing the exact same thing at the same time, rounding up Jewish and ethnic minorities for work and eventually death camps. Yet we were taking the moral high ground. This is Tatiana Hopper, photographer and educator, in a video from 2023.
And the truth is that during a great part of her career, Lang worked extensively for the Farm Security Administration, which was an organization part of the US government. So naturally, she sided with many of FDR's programs and laws, until she was confronted with the circumstances of these people, imprisoned without apparent reason other than their ancestry and or nationality. So these photos mark a period of change for the photographer because, unlike many of her peers and colleagues, she was notoriously against the discrimination of Japanese Americans, and for that matter, all Americans independently of their heritage and skin color. Because Lang had experienced herself hardship for greater part of her childhood, and traveling extensively across the country whilst on photography assignments had also shown her the social injustices of her country. She reportedly even gave some of her photos of the camps to be published in pamphlets against the camps and to make the public aware of what was going on, and I believe personally she discovered then another side of the country and people for which she worked for during a greater part of her life.
The camps were eventually closed in 1945 when the war ended. Families went back home to find their houses and apartments taken, their businesses sold, their entire communities desecrated and vandalized. And the photos that Dorothea took, they were hidden away. So many people for many years never knew what happened to the Japanese Americans. After the war ended, Dorothea kept taking photos. She traveled around the world, documenting communities in Egypt, Ecuador, Korea, and elsewhere. She was often plagued by illness, and she finally succumbed in 1965.
The photographer puts a camera around her neck in the morning, along with shoes. And there it is. It is an appendage. And it shares its life. This is a peculiar and a powerful instrument for this purpose of saying to you, this is the way it is. Look at it. Look at it. One should use the camera as though tomorrow you'd be stricken blind. To live a visual life is it. Enormous undertaking, practically unattainable. But when the great photographs are produced, it will be down that road. I have only touched it, just touched it.
Before Dorothea, photography as an art form was pretty focused on being objective. The idea being the photographer was an anonymous eye for the public. But Dorothea knew innately that objectivity was a fallacy. How can you be objective when witnessing such misery? Here's Tatiana Hopper again, speaking specifically about Dorothea's photos of the Japanese Americans.
To be objective or to not be objective? I think this is a relevant question when we talk about documentary photography, because after all, it's like when we talk about a documentary film. We can have something where we take a clear point of view, or on the inverse, simply assume an observational, more neutral point of view. And here Lang takes what seems to be a more observational point of view. But the key word here is seems. Because in my opinion, in her portraits and the scenes she captures, she showcases people with a lot of dignity and morals. People who tend to their beliefs, that work hard and kept a peaceful and respectful living despite the conditions and visible discrimination they had to face. To me personally, I think it's quite impossible to be objective when the subject is this. Because the way the photographer chooses to capture its subject, the framing, the portraits, is or can be a conscious or subconscious decision that is profoundly based on an emotional reaction of how she perceived the scene. And I think Lang captured the objective reality, which was that these people were no threat to anyone. They were quite normal, and their activities such as working, spending time with the family, house chores, are not any different than any other average American family.
In a world today where everything comes from an angle or an algorithm, it's easy to lament some supposed past times when journalists were neutral and photographers objective. But I don't think that was ever the case. Journalism always comes from people, and often corporations and billionaires who own the presses. Art always comes from people, and with every choice made, they leave their personal mark and take. Dorothea might say we should embrace that, as the camera and perhaps other art is a tool.
The camera is an instrument that teaches people how to see without a camera.
So what can we learn from this? We go with our gut. The things that scare us, the things that others tell us not to do, might be the things that define us and impact the world. We tell and show the truth, the terrible, ugly truths of this world. And we commit to making art as resistance for the long term, for a better world. The Art of Resistance is a podcast for the artists, the lovers of art, and people who want to resist but don't know how. These stories are designed to help us find inspiration from the past and empower us all to find some hope for today and tomorrow. I'm Amy Lee Lillard, and I wrote, narrated, and produced this show. And there's so much more to this story. At artofresistance.space, you'll find sources, images, and videos for this episode and all the others. Here's an easy way to learn more about Art as Resistance. Sign up for the free newsletter at artofresistance.space and get stories and tips every week. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.